Hello, I'm Hazem Sika. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, it was seen as a slap in the face to President Biden. OPEC Plus's move to cut oil output has drawn angry criticism from Washington. Why did they do it, and how will the U.S. respond? Also this week, the world's financial firefighter. But few people like its harsh lending conditions. We look at the role of the International Monetary Fund in these gloomy economic times. Is it losing relevance? And while some African countries aren't ready yet to let go of fossil fuels, others are turning to green energy sources to lower their carbon footprint. Now, for months, President Joe Biden has lobbied Saudi Arabia and the other oil-producing countries to help ease energy prices by pumping more oil into the market. But in a major policy reversal, OPEC Plus, that includes Russia, decided to cut output by 2 million barrels a day in November. The U.S. is calling the decision short-sighted. It has accused the kingdom of siding with Moscow, which relies heavily on its oil revenues. OPEC Plus says the move is purely economic, a response to uncertainty about future demand for oil.
Our priority now is stabilizing market. Now, we could be accused of wanting to influence market in a negative way. That's everybody's prerogative. You and others will see how we conduct ourselves in the months to come.
Well, Biden has vowed what he calls consequences for Saudi Arabia over the OPEC Plus decision to slash output. It is the biggest reduction by the group since the height of the pandemic in 2020. But actual cuts are likely to be smaller because many OPEC members aren't meeting their targets. The price of a barrel of Brent crude jumped to more than $93 after the announcement last week. It was on a downward trend in late September from highs of about $130. The U.S. has pledged to release 10 million barrels from its stockpiles next month in an attempt to keep oil prices down. And the U.S. is considering steps to reduce OPEC's control over energy prices. They include the No Oil Producing and Exporting Cartels, or NOPEC bill. It's meant to protect American consumers and businesses from engineered oil spikes. It's been debated for more than two decades, and a Senate Judiciary Committee passed it in May, but it needs to pass the full Senate and House and signed by the president to become law. The bill would enable the U.S. to revoke the sovereign immunity, which protects OPEC Plus members and their national oil companies from lawsuits. The U.S. Attorney General would have the option to sue the oil cartel members in federal court. So to discuss all of this, I'm joined now from New York by Antoine Hauth, former chief oil analyst at the International Energy Agency and currently an adjunct senior research scholar at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University and the co-founder and chief oil analyst at Kairos. Good to have you with us. So OPEC and now the OPEC Plus alliance has never cut output this much and this quickly. Why now?
Yeah, it might seem surprising. It's a much more proactive cut than we've seen in the past. If you look at satellite imaging of inventories today, there's no sign of overhang. There's no oversupply today. Stocks have been fairly flat for the last few weeks. But I think there's concerns that they are going to increase. There's concerns about a looming recession. And the fact that stocks have been flat might be seen as a warning signal, because normally stocks globally tend to decrease in September and October. So it's somewhat surprising. It's unusual for OPEC to cut supply in the face of a recession. Typically, the language is more that OPEC is willing to take a price cut to help the economy. But it's understanding, and I think most people who were watching balances, supply-demand balances, were expecting a fairly significant cut. Obviously, it's taken the U.S. government by surprise.
But OPEC Plus says it's trying to get ahead of the curve. But are there any indications of a slump in demand, and how soon could that happen?
There's clearly severe impacts from the rally in natural gas prices and the constraints on the gas market. If you look at industrial activity in Europe, in Germany and other countries in Europe, there's been a very sharp decline in activity from cement kilns, from steel mills. on the consumer side, on the oil side specifically, the impact is less flagrant right now. There's been a little bit of a lack of a boost in demand in the summer, for example. The summer driving demand in the US and in Europe was very weak. Airline demand is still very, very diminished. And there are concerns looking forward. So there are certainly expectations of a decline. It hasn't really materialized in the oil market as much as in other aspects of the energy spectrum. But there's concerns about future contraction, that's for sure.
But the cuts are likely to be less than 2 million barrels because many countries aren't meeting output targets. So how effective is this reduction going to be on prices then?
Yeah, nobody expects 2 million. Obviously, it's 2 million on paper. In practice, it's going to be less than 1 million. Expectations vary from 700 to 800,000 barrels per day. That's going to be less than the shock value, the sticker shock of the 2 million is not going to be matched in practice. And if you look at the market reaction, the price has not increased so much. So I think the market participants are fairly comfortable that the market can take this kind of cut.
And the U.S. is accusing Saudi Arabia of siding with Russia in making this decision. So how much would these cuts then benefit Moscow?
Well, any cut is beneficial to Moscow because if there's a reduction in exports, or even if there's no reduction in exports, the price increase will obviously help Moscow maintain export revenue and finance its war effort. So there's obviously concerns there. And the Russian economy has been fairly resilient to sanctions. There hasn't been a collapse in the Russian economy, but there's signs of friction, of tension. And I think over time, Moscow is clearly going to feel the impact of sanctions and of the impact of its war effort on its own budget.
And the U.S. is saying that it could release oil from its national stockpiles as appropriate, it says. But how much could they release and how much of a difference is that going to make on prices?
Well, the U.S. SPR is still very large. It's the largest in the world. And there's a significant drawing capacity in the U.S., The U.S. has been drawing on its reserves and has accelerated the pace of destocking of the SPR since March. I think that was a great decision initially. It calmed the market when the market was concerned about an abrupt stop in Russian supply, where that actually did not happen. And probably the U.S. should have been more agile in adjusting the pace of destocking of drawers from the SPR earlier on. Now the SPR cut is completely offset by the OPEC production cut. The SPR release is completely offset. The U.S. obviously has the option of increasing the pace of destocking. I don't think it would be necessarily a wise idea. It would deplete the reserve, and it would not really serve any purpose, not bring any benefit right now. But it's an option if the market gets too tight.
And this NOPEC bill, the so-called NOPEC bill that's being considered in the U.S. right now, could that become a law? And, what difference... will it make? I mean, is it going to affect OPEC's dominance on the energy prices?
Listen, there's clearly an uproar in Washington, a sense of hurt, a sense of pain, and an eagerness to examine what kind of policy tools, what kind of measures could be taken to express displeasure. And NOPEC is one of those tools. It's a bit ironic because just 2 years ago, everybody in the U.S. was begging OPEC to cut supply, from the president to producers to local authorities, and was willing to participate in the supply cuts at the height of the COVID pandemic. So I don't think, based on this recent experience, that the legislation has any legs, but it certainly can be a nuisance, can be a distraction, and can be an irritant in the relationship. And there's a strong likelihood that there's going to be sustained interest in reviving this piece of legislation.
And what other options does the U.S. have, if any, at this point, to get oil prices down?
Well, to get oil prices down, if there's a need to really bring them down in a big way, they could suddenly increase the SPR. They could, the industry could pick up the pace of fracking in the shale patch, and there could be an effort to bring supply from areas that have been restricted, like Venezuela, like Iran. And I think it's no coincidence that we hear some interest in trying to lift the the foot from the pedal of Venezuelan sanctions. The Iranian negotiations are continuing, and there's some strong interest from the market sense in bringing them to fruition.
All right, Antoine Hauff, good to get your analysis. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Now, the International Monetary Fund is often called the lender of last resort. Countries look to it for financial assistance in times of crisis. It was created more than seven decades ago to promote economic stability after World War II. But the world has changed a great deal since then. And now the pandemic, as well as the war in Ukraine, are threatening economic conditions around the world. It's leading many people to question the IMF's relevance in 2022. The critics have taken aim at its demand for reforms and austerity in exchange for bailout loans. But many countries at risk of defaulting on their debt are still seeking financial help from the IMF. Pakistan has political turmoil and devastating floods to deal with. They just secured a loan of around $1 billion. Sri Lanka is close to finalizing almost $3 billion, while Egypt is also in talks for a new loan. Lending programs are expected to increase as the IMF paints a gloomy outlook for the global economy. The institution has cut global growth forecasts for next year to 2.7% and warns the worst is yet to come. It mainly blames Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the cost of living crisis, and China's economic slowdown for the downturn. The IMF predicts the world's output will shrink by $4 trillion between now and 2026. That is almost the size of the German economy. More than 100 nations requested bailouts from the IMF more than 2 years ago at the height of the COVID-19 health crisis. And the institution has around $140 billion in outstanding loans to 44 member countries. Argentina is the biggest debtor with a total outstanding amount of more than $42 billion, followed by Egypt at around $17 billion. The IMF says 60% of low-income countries are now at high risk or already in debt distress. And a growing number of middle-income countries are suffering from high debt service burdens. The UN estimates 54 countries, that's more than half the world's poorest people, need immediate debt relief to avoid extreme poverty. And from Washington, D.C., I'm joined now by Scott Morris, Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development. Good to have you with us, Scott. So first off, Sri Lanka and Pakistan are among the countries facing debt distress. What has led us to this point with them?
Well, I think you have a very difficult combination of factors for both countries, some of them homegrown in terms of their own policy decisions. Frankly, in Sri Lanka's case, really, really deep problems in governance, to some degree with Pakistan as well, but frankly also global forces that are in play right now that are exacerbating these situations, rising interest rates, the ongoing effects of the pandemic. So it really is this confluence of forces that are hitting both countries very hard.
And are the IMF loans helping countries like this, or do they make things worse?
Well, to some degree, I think the IMF gets a bad reputation in part because it does show up at times when countries are facing their worst situations in terms of crisis. But on the other hand, I think there is a long history of the IMF not always getting things right in terms of the judgments they make. And I think that, this can happen in a couple of different ways. One, I think there have been periods where the IMF has imposed conditions on their loans that are more harm than help. Too much austerity in some situations, too much reach into the decision-making of the government across a wide range of issues. There are also times, frankly, when the IMF is too easy. And here, I think that applies more to the position of other creditors to these countries, where the IMF allows these creditors too much position in the bargaining, because oftentimes what these countries need, certainly if we look at Sri Lanka right now, Their creditors are going to have to take haircuts. They're going to have to write down some of this debt. And the IMF plays an important role in helping navigate that situation, making sure that everyone is bearing a fair share of the cost of working out of these crises.
So do you see the IMF adapting its approach at all to the current circumstances?
So if we look back to 2020 and the pandemic as a trigger for a lot of economic problems in the world, the IMF really did step up. They opened their lending windows. They did it quickly with low conditionality. So we saw a lot of money flowing out of the institution. But frankly, since that time, we haven't seen that kind of stance from the fund. Countries have not been borrowing. So it remains to be seen. I think these two countries that you named are probably on the front edge of what will be a growing number of countries in crisis. And it really will be important to see how the IMF responds. Will they provide quicker access to their money? Will they set aside traditional conditionality to ensure that countries have the financing that they need to weather this crisis?
Now, there are a number of countries in the world that are facing some level of debt distress. Do you think the IMF is doing enough to help the global south?
I think, to their credit, they're showing signs of preparing. So they're creating new lending windows, some focused on food security distress right now, which is certainly laudable. They've created a new resilience trust fund. So all these trust funds, they've been spending time setting up, but we haven't seen them perform yet. And these are, they are particularly targeted at low-income countries because if they are tapped, they offer much easier terms, financial terms, very low interest rates. But we haven't seen yet large volumes of funds flowing out of these facilities. And I think the real test will be one of scale. As you say, we are likely to see a significantly larger number of countries, many of them among the poorest countries in the world. For a large number of these countries, this truly is a shock that is not of their own making. Whether it's the food security issues associated with the war in Ukraine, ongoing issues of the pandemic, none of these things were problems created by these countries or their governments. So, the issue around conditionality is a key one here. This is not necessarily the moment to try to leverage policy reforms in these governments when they're trying to deal with crises that were not of their own making.
And of course, each country has its own monetary policies dealing with its own set of challenges. But do you think the IMF is doing enough to promote the stability of the international monetary system as a whole?
Yeah, well, this is a key question right now. And I think this has more to do with the IMF's relationship with its rich country members. So obviously, there's a lot of attention on the Federal Reserve here in the U.S. and their actions, which are guided by domestic requirements and domestic law. But clearly, there are ramifications and significant negative ramifications for other countries in the world in terms of the interest rate effects. So what we would like to see and what we want to see is coordination between the U.S., between European governments, and the IMF on ways in which they can deal with this collateral damage for other countries. And we've seen that in past crises. The Federal Reserve has opened swap lines with other central banks in the world. I think that is in coordination with the IMF and IMF lending. China today, we've seen them at least put on the offer of these kinds of swap lines from their central bank. It's not clear yet if the terms of that offer are flexible enough for countries to make use of them. Sri Lanka is one case where there was a swap line open with China, but the prudential standards of that arrangement were too too rigid in a way that Sri Lanka could not make use of it before the default.
Scott Morris, good to get your perspective. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Now, the race to green energy is going too fast for some oil-rich developing nations. Nigeria is Africa's biggest exporter of oil, and it isn't ready to let go of its huge reserves that have fueled its consumption and economic growth for more than half a century. Al Jazeera's Ahmed Idris reports from Port Harcourt.
This offshore rig pumps oil and gas off the coast of Nigeria. For more than 60 years, petroleum has been the pillar of its economy. And for many here, life without oil is simply unimaginable.
We know for sure that even by 2050, fossil fuel will still account for about 58% of energy production in the world. That means that fossil fuel is not going to go away, but it's going to be converted to much, much cleaner, cleaner fuel. And that is really our focus.
Petroleum contributes more than half of Nigeria's budget and more than 90% of its foreign exchange earnings. Experts say ditching it could devastate the economy. The World Bank says Nigeria's dependence on oil is greater than that of many other major producers.
More than half of Africa's 1.3 billion people have no access to power. Here in Nigeria, the figure is more than 45%. Officials here say they want to increase access to electricity, especially by exploiting the country's oil and gas resources to encourage growth.
Industry experts say Africa's oil will still find a ready market on the continent, even if the rest of the world shuts its doors.
Africa needs energy. We are not selling energy outside because we don't need it. We are selling energy outside because we have misplaced priorities.
Nigeria wants to be seen as playing its part in reducing global warming. 2 years ago, the government declared 2020 to 2030 as a decade of gas, a 10-year period to shift focus from oil and more to natural gas as a cleaner transition fuel. But that doesn't mean the country will abandon its 37 billion barrels of crude oil reserves altogether.
Well, Kenya is making major changes to its energy supply system. The country is now harvesting geothermal steam. Consultants on the project say it will cut greenhouse gas emissions, but also lift millions of people out of poverty. Catherine Soy reports from the Olkaria power plant in Naivasha.
Blasts of immense heat dot dozens of vents in the Great Rift Valley. The steam is so hot, you can boil an egg in it. To appreciate the power of this heat, there is nowhere better to look than northwest of Kenya's capital, Nairobi. This energy is coming from the earth, and it's essentially limitless. Anna Mwangi is exploring for new geothermal drill sites for the country's electricity generating company. It is producing 962 megawatts of power, but could do a great deal more. Scientists say harnessing geothermal power for electricity is simple.
The steam from the ground is channeled in a steam lines, and these steam lines end up in a power plant, and that steam, of course, it is separated where the liquid phase is taken, injected back into the ground, and the steam, dry steam, is taken to a power plant and runs a turbine generating electricity.
Kenya derives most of its energy from clean sources. It has some of the world's largest geothermal wells and plants. It is also the largest producer of wind and geothermal energy on the continent.
I think Africa stands out now as a viable option to bring about the change so that Africa will make the necessary contribution to greening the environment. And that's why you find major economies having an interest in Kenya specifically and in Africa, basically to reverse the effects of what is happening elsewhere.
Francis Karaoke was recently connected to the grid through a rural electrification program.
Now we have light. We also have fewer cases of theft at night, but there are still people in darkness. You need to light up the entire village.
In most parts, people are now enjoying the benefits of renewable energy.
Many Kenyans are connected to the national grid. while others have installed solar systems. The government says it wants to ensure every home has electricity in the next 10 years.
The idea is, and its goal, is not just to light up the country, but the whole continent.
And that is our show for this week. Remember, you can get in touch with us by tweeting me at Hazem Seeker, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Hazem Seeker. From the whole team here, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.